reading from verse 1 to verse 17. And as you know, the focus of this text is what we call the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. So Exodus chapter 20 and verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of Yahweh your God in vain, for Yahweh will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to Yahweh your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days Yahweh made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore Yahweh blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that Yahweh your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. Now let me read to you something else, a little bit from an article that gives us a pretty good analogy for where we are in our study of the book of Exodus. Quote, when the rains came, the winds howled and the temperature dipped. Aaron Lickudine, 24 years old, of West Lynn, Oregon, scrambled to find shelter. With no food, water, cell phone, compass, or the proper clothes, Lickudine, who was hiking the Oregon Badlands wilderness area near Bend, finally hunkered down in a cave. When he failed to return to the campsite, his friend dialed 911. Nearly 40 members of the Deschutes County Sheriff's Search and Rescue Team bounded into action, riding horses and ATVs in search of the missing hiker. A helicopter took Searchers scoured the countryside. The next day, rescue workers found Lickudine, cold, wet, and hungry, but otherwise okay. Experts say he did most everything wrong when he went for his jaunt in the 30,000-acre wilderness that contains harsh terrain, lava flows, ancient junipers, and rock formations. He was not properly prepared. He didn't have a map, nor did he have a compass or cell phone, all of which are essential when hiking. He didn't even have the right clothes. Whether walking across the Appalachian Trail or the backcountry of Oregon, proper preparation is crucial on a long hike. Having the right clothes, enough food, and the correct gear will not only make the experience more enjoyable, but it could save your life. And so the author of this article has all kinds of recommendations for what you ought to do if you're going to launch out on a long hike. And he breaks them up into five categories. There are safety measures. There is food and water. There is foot care. There is gear, and there is physical fitness. And as I read through that, a lot of it was common sense, but this one was a little surprising. Among the safety items, they say duct tape is important. Duct tape can mend clothing, repair holes in tents and sleeping bags. Hikers can even use it to bind up a blistered foot, which sounds painful just reading that. But anyway, why do I share this about preparations for hiking and what this particular man failed to do? It's very much like what we have been doing here the last few weeks as we have been slowly moving out of chapter 19 and into chapter 20 of the book of Exodus. For these weeks, it's like we have been at the bottom of Mount Sinai. We have been getting oriented. We have been trying to get a sense of the lay of the land and what is required to properly understand this. We have prepared to hike up the massive, imposing mountain, really mountain range, that is the Old Covenant law. And as we've been doing that, I have tried to explain, first of all, what not to do with this law that we're going to start considering, and various ways in which the New Testament tells us we are not under the law. But then there's been the positive side the last couple of weeks, where I've tried to explain what it is we are to do with the law. How it is that that law of God, even though it was given in the context of the Old Covenant, it continues in many ways to instruct us in this New Covenant age. In fact, you may have noticed that with today's bulletin, there was a handout, and it was basically a summary of the key ideas from the message last week. It's entitled, Discerning the Application of Individual Old Testament Laws. And I want to encourage you to tuck that away in your Bible. Use it for your own personal study whenever you happen to be reading through the Pentateuch. But also because as we go through these next weeks in our series in Exodus, I'm going to be referring back again and again to the points that I brought out last week about how all of this actually applies to our lives. Today we're actually not going to get very far on our hike. Partially because we have the Lord's table here, and I want to be sure that we devote some good time to that ordinance. But it's also because the Lord, as He's beginning to lay these things out, He doesn't seem to be in a hurry. I mean, He gave all of chapter 19 as a kind of an introduction, and there are some other introductory comments that He makes in verses 1 and 2 of Exodus 20. You might remember that when I was walking through chapter 19, I describe verses 1 to 6 as the preamble or the prologue to the Old Covenant. And in reality, these two verses continue to function as a kind of preamble. They further prepare the way for a right understanding of what this law is going to be. And so this morning, we're going to deal with just those two verses under the title, Approaching the Decalogue. We are getting very close to looking with some detail at the expectations that God lays out here in Exodus 20 and forward, and we're getting right up to them, and we're trying to have God's own context and interpretation. We're approaching the Decalogue, striving to view it the way He intends. And what we're going to see is that these verses give us three characteristics of the Decalogue in particular that will give us the right perspective and the right attitude we need as we then come back and start to look at the individual commandments. And here's the first thought, and it's not something that is developed very much. It is really a comment that shows up a lot in the Old Testament, but it is huge in its significance. It is not something to take for granted. And that is the simple fact, I mean, look at verse 1, and God spoke all these words. And I want to make the point, first of all, that the Decalogue is uniquely revealed. God spoke all these words, saying, etc. These commandments And not just these, but all the ones coming after, they come from God Himself. And in the case of the Ten Commandments, there really is a unique revealed character to them. You read the Pentateuch, and it's going to make very clear that all 613 commandments of the law were given by Yahweh Himself. They were not Moses' idea. They were certainly not the idea of the people of Israel. And yet, even though all of them came from God, what we find is that in a unique sense, the Ten Commandments came from God, and therefore they have a special and a dominant place among all of the laws that we're going to encounter. I want you to consider several key facts that point us to the uniquely revealed character of these Ten Commandments. First of all, they are given first. Among all those 613 that are going to stretch out for another three books, they are given first. They are placed first in the list of Yahweh's requirements for Israel. I think that in itself is significant. Number two, these were the only commandments that were spoken audibly by Yahweh Himself to the whole nation. The text says God spoke all these words. And the audience of those words was the entire nation. Most of the time, it is God speaking to Moses, and then Moses turns around and he passes them on to the people of Israel. In this case, it was God speaking audibly and forcefully to where everybody in that nation could hear him. How loud must that voice have been? They didn't have PA systems. How loud must that voice have been for the entire nation to have gotten it, such that in the passage in Deuteronomy 5, they're saying, we can't take this. Moses, you go up and get the law for us. But that was unique to these Ten Commandments. Number three, when we read later on what happened with these Ten Commandments, you find in Exodus 31:18 and other places that God not only spoke them, but He actually Himself wrote them on tablets of stone. In fact, it says that they were written by the finger of God. No other law is that said about. These ten, He takes the effort to somehow emblazon them on these tablets of stone as a record of what He had said. And furthermore, number four, what was done with those tablets, or actually the second version, because the first version Moses threw down and destroyed in his anger at the people's idolatry. God redid it, gave a version two with the same laws, and those tablets were then taken. Exodus 40 says this, Deuteronomy 10 says this, they were placed within the Ark of the Covenant as an ongoing testimony to what the Lord had said and written down. That's not said about anything else in the Pentateuch. And furthermore, you can consider this, the Ten Commandments are actually treated as a distinctive unit within the whole package of laws. For example, in Exodus 34, verse 28, they are out and out called the Ten Words. Like they had a label that was given to them originally. We didn't come up with this idea of the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. That is actually right in the text that they are called that as its own collection that has a distinctive role to play. In fact, number six, those Ten Words are actually a shorthand for the entire covenant. There are passages where the Ten Commandments are equated with the covenant. One of them, I'll read you here, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 13. Moses, looking back on this, says, He declared to you His covenant, which He commanded you to perform. That is the Ten Commandments, and He wrote them on the two tablets of stone. The covenant is summarized in those Ten Commandments. They are used as a way to speak of the entire thing. And again, that is not said about other commandments. And building off of that, and the reason I think that they can be equated with the covenant is because they are very broad categories of God's expectations. They are foundational and principial in nature rather than being highly specific laws that you might expect in a legal code. They are very broad in their expectation. And I think you see that especially in the last commandment that we read, the 10th commandment. When the Lord says, you must not covet. How could something like that even be enforced as a law? Like, how could a policeman come up to you and say, I caught you, you're coveting? That's not really a law in the traditional sense. It's not something you actually do. It's something invisible inside. It has to do with your desires getting out of control. It's dealing with the thoughts and the motives of the Israelites. You see how I'm saying this is a matter of principle, and it's targeting issues that a specific law code really cannot address effectively. And you also see that concept in that when you look at the other commands and you compare them with the, 603 that are left, basically you could analyze all those 603 as extensions of the 10, as applications of the 10. And that would be a good question for you to consider as you're wrestling with some of those harder laws. You know, is there any connection with something that was taught by the 10 commandments? Is this some kind of application of the Ten Commandments? That speaks to the foundational nature of these ten. So there I gave you seven reasons that the Ten Commandments have a unique and a dominant role among everything that God gave to the people of Israel. Now last week I explained why I don't divide up the Old Covenant law into the three traditional categories of moral, civil, and ceremonial. But at the same time, as I think on those points, I can at least appreciate why many theologians want to call the Decalogue a summary of the moral law. There is all of this moral expectation set in these very emphatic terms, in these very broad categories, where the Lord is directly and he is powerfully getting to core issues, to issues of ethics and morality. You don't have to do a lot of sifting through about Old Covenant, New Covenant for most of them, because right on the surface, they are just declaring the will of God, and it is just on the surface, applicable, universal in nature, God's will for everybody. And it also gets to heart issues. It's not so concerned about all of these details that have to do with the nation of Israel. It's targeting human nature and the law that we all have emblazoned on our hearts by God's own work and through our conscience. So we want to give this the unique status that it really is given in the Scripture itself. It is uniquely revealed. Now, I make that point, but I want us to consider what effect all of that should have on our own understanding of, our own viewpoint of these laws. We could say many things, but I want to remind you of the passage that I started out the service with from Deuteronomy chapter 5. And that is where Moses is again recounting this incident, giving us a little bit more information about what happened and how God replied when they were so taken aback by all this truth that the Lord was just booming out at them. And the Lord allows Moses and encourages Moses to take up that role of intercessor. But he also says, oh, that they had such a heart as this always to fear me and keep all my commandments that it might go well with them and with their descendants forever. What I'm saying is that one of the effects it ought to have on us when we see, look, in a unique way, this is the word of God. God was serious about this. It ought to move us to fear the Lord. Now, what does that look like? Thomas Watson developed that issue further. In fact, I think one of the earliest Puritan books I ever purchased, probably 30 years ago, was Thomas Watson's book on the Ten Commandments. The classic work in this whole area. And in true Puritan fashion, he wrote like 25 pages, just jam-packed with text and jam-packed with scripture, 25 pages on just Exodus 20, verse 1 and verse 2. And here is what he has to say to this point, that this is uniquely revealed by God. He says, number one, if God spoke all these words, then we must hear all these words, as we would have God hear all our words when we pray, right? Don't you want God to hear your words when you pray? He says, so we must hear all His words when He speaks. Number two, he says, if God spoke all these words, then we must attend to them with reverence. Not just hear them, but hold them in high esteem and revere Him and what He is saying. In fact, it goes on to say God Himself is the preacher. It's not Moses standing up. It's not your pastor standing up. In this case, in a unique way, it's God Himself talking directly. And he says God Himself is the preacher, which calls for reverence. Number two, three, if God spoke all these words, then we must remember them. Keep them in mind. Don't let them slip. Our memory should be like that chest in the ark where the law was kept. These Puritans had a way of coming up with these analogies to make the point. I said the law was put in the ark, and he says, really, your mind ought to be kind of like that ark, a chest that really retains this and treasures this internally. He says, if God spoke all these words, then believe them. Don't question them. Don't doubt them. See the name of God written upon every commandment. And then he gives us another analogy. He reminds us of what happened in the Garden of Eden. He said Eve gave more credit to the devil when he spake than she did to God. And isn't that often our own experience? That we believe our own fallen thoughts or the words of men, which may end up being the words of the devil, we give them more heed and believe them and trust them more than the words of God. Watson goes on to say, if God spoke all these words, then love the commandments. Like the psalmist, whom he quotes in Psalm 119:97, oh, how love I thy law. It is my meditation all the day. Here's another thought. If God spoke all these words, then teach your children the law of God. Though you cannot impart grace to your children, yet you may impart knowledge. And he says, you are careful to leave your children a portion or an inheritance. He says, leave the oracles of heaven with them. Instruct them in the law of God. And finally, if God spoke all these words, the moral law must be obeyed. If a king speaks, his word commands allegiance. Much more when God speaks, must his words be obeyed. And so the Decalogue is uniquely revealed by God and calls for that kind of response. Now, those are very convicting points. And as I say, Watson just goes on and on along these lines. However, if that is all we think of, and if we stop there in our perspective of the commandments, we really could start viewing them in the wrong way. We really could start thinking of them just as another list of rules to keep. And that is why the next point is so important. As we come to verse 2, we realize that the Decalogue, yes, it's uniquely revealed, but the Decalogue is emphatically relational. I'll say that again. The Decalogue is not just a list of rules. It is emphatically relational in nature. If you've ever thought about this, but when you put all of the Ten Commandments together, one of the things that is so impressive about this is how comprehensive they are. That in principle, they cover every category of the lives of the Israelites. Not in detail, but every category. Think about those commandments I read. Here are the topics that are brought up. People's worship. People's work. People's use of time. Marriage. Family. Sexuality. Other relationships in society and how you treat people. people's possessions or their property, people's speech, the words that come out of your mouth, your integrity or honesty, and as I mentioned earlier, your heart desires. It is hard to think of an aspect of life that does not fall somehow under those headings. It's just amazing when you compare this with the great documents and the great literature of ancient civilizations, how compact this is and how, in principle, it basically covers all of life. The question is, why does God talk as though he can actually tell you what to do about everything? Why does he talk as though he has the right to mandate every area of people's lives? Somebody might say, well, at a basic level, God made us. He is the creator, and therefore he is our owner, and therefore he has absolute authority over us. And because we are his creatures, we are bound to do whatever he says about whatever topic. He doesn't put us in the position where we have the right or where it's our place to decide what is right and what is wrong. And that is a true point. And that is a part of what we need to consider. And really, it ought to be enough to explain why we owe obedience to God. He made us. And he also made the world. And he knows how the world works best and how the world accomplishes its purposes. So naturally, he has the insight to guide us as to how to make the best use of life. But that's not really how the Lord frames this. He could have said it that way. He could have just said, look, I'm in charge here. Not your place to be determining what you want to do with your life. But that is not the way that he approaches people, even under the old covenant. Look again at verse 2. And before he gives any commandments, he says, I am Yahweh, your God. That is so much warmer, so much more appealing than just the Lord saying, I'm in charge here. He says, I am Yahweh, your God. Folks, that is gracious covenant language. And hopefully you remember some of the things that we dealt with when back in chapter 3 of Exodus, the Lord introduced to Moses his personal name, Yahweh. And I emphasized back there that that is a relational name, that that has to do with God's covenant. And the Lord connects that name with the fact that out of all the pagans who were living in the world at the time, the Lord unilaterally decided to show favor to one individual, and his name was Abraham. And he did for Abraham something he didn't do with anyone else. He revealed himself to this man in a very personal and specific way, and he drew Abraham to faith in himself. And Abraham embraced this God who had approached him and taken the initiative. And then the Lord makes a special covenant with Abraham that distinguished this man and his future descendants among all the peoples of the earth. And as a part of that, God began to work to keep those promises by providing a son for Abraham, even though he and his wife Sarah were way past the years of childbearing. And there were other barren wives in that family to whom God also gave children, so this promise could continue. And by the end of Genesis, Yahweh, taking the first steps of revealing what that name is, there were 75 descendants that came out of this man. And furthermore, God used the sin of Jacob's sons to get Joseph down to Egypt and eventually to get the whole family down there, because God, being the relational covenant God that he is, wanted to preserve this family from the famine that had overtaken the earth. And over the course of the four centuries between that and what we're reading here, God kept multiplying this people to where they were now a nation of some 2 million people. He preserved them through years of intense slavery. And then he miraculously destroyed the forces of Egypt so that he could deliver these people from the clutches of Pharaoh. And all of that is connected with Yahweh. Yahweh is the God of election. Yahweh is the God of covenant. Yahweh is the God of miraculous works to keep his promises. Yahweh is the God of mighty deliverances. All of this is an extension. It is a demonstration of what it means that God is a relational God. He did all of these things because he was so faithful to his promises and he was so committed to this group of people. Folks, that is the God. That is the God who gives the Ten Commandments. He wants these people to know that. Yes, I'm the authority, but that's not really my emphasis. My emphasis is, I'm your God. I'm for you. I love you. I drew you to myself. I made a covenant with you. I am Yahweh, your God, who is speaking these things. He's not like a drill sergeant yelling orders from heaven. But he is a loving God who has entered into a special relationship with these people. So the law never was a way to get God's attention so that he would be willing to have a relationship with Israel. It was a way for them to live out the gracious personal relationship that God had already provided for them. He doesn't say, I'm going to be your God. I am Yahweh, your God. We already have this foundation of relationship between God and this nation. He presents himself as a God who is for these people, not against them. And furthermore, he is a God who gives these people those laws for their good. He doesn't do it just to make them squirm, just to make them feel weak, and just to kind of humiliate them. That's not the point. These laws are for their good. This is what is best for them. This is, in God's world that he created to work according to certain patterns, this is what is going to make for their flourishing in his world. This is what is wise and how to best use all of the opportunities that God has surrounded your life with in the world that he has created. Folks, that's how they needed to view the law. It is coming out of this relationship and this favor. It is Yahweh, our God, speaking, and that is how we need to view the law as well. It isn't a list of requirements to check off or a set of cold and abstract principles. It is the outflow of this gracious relationship that Yahweh had made with them. I like the way that one writer put it. He says, God makes his own redemptive initiative of grace the foundation of the law. This majestic opening chord of the Decalogue launches it in the indicative, not the imperative mood. Now, I've used that language a lot before when it comes to the New Testament epistles, right? So Paul will write a letter and he gives all this doctrine. And there's all the indicative of the way things are by God's grace through Jesus Christ in the gospel. The imperative comes after that and flows from that as far as now what we must do in response. What I'm saying here is that that approach didn't start with Paul. It's actually the way the law is set up. I am Yahweh your God, indicative. Therefore, do these things, imperative. He keeps the same order. Before he gives those commandments, he does not want his people to miss that relational emphasis. And so he makes one more comment that is our third point this morning to bring out one of the dimensions of that relationship. And that is that the Decalogue, if I could put it this way, it is wisely responsive. And I'll explain what I mean by that. My first thought was that it is uniquely revealed. Secondly, that it is emphatically relational. And number three, that it is wisely responsive. That is, it has to do with our response to how God has already worked And in what he gave us to do in response, there is a lot of wisdom that is interwoven into it. Verse 2 finishes up with this other comment. Not only I am Yahweh your God, but I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, again, I could make a parallel between the epistles and this, where there's all this doctrine, and then there's a little word often that links it with the imperative, and it's the word therefore. And basically what I'm saying is that between verse 2 and verse 3, there's an assumed therefore. In other words, because I am your God, who got you out of Egypt from the house of slavery, therefore you need to worship only me. That is the response. And throughout the Old Testament, the Lord keeps reminding these people of the amazing works that he had done to free them from their bondage in Egypt. And he took them out of there for the purpose that they would have the freedom and the opportunity to serve him. And their obedience to him is presented as that response to the God who has so powerfully delivered us. On one level, you could say that the obedience is a matter of gratitude. And it is a matter of worship, where the people, so touched by all of these interventions God has done to show his heart for them, they're like, Lord, what do you want me to do? Right? That's the attitude. God, what now? My life obviously belongs to you. What do you want me to do? I love you. I'm so thankful. I adore you because of your great works on my behalf. What can I do to bring you pleasure? Right? That is the spirit. And that's part of the response here. But there is even more that we can say beyond that. And I appreciate how some writers have looked at those Ten Commandments and now talking more about the wisdom of it. They see that those responses and some of the actual commandments, they correspond to dimensions of the former life of Israel, where God had gotten them out of there, and now he gives them something to do that is kind of an answer to what they had been freed from. Okay? And let me illustrate this for you. What's the first commandment? Don't worship anybody else. Is it not true that Pharaoh proudly claimed divine status? And God says, I got you out of that. Forget about that. Nobody can claim that for himself. I'm the only God. Worship me. Consider as well that Egyptian religion overflowed with physical objects of worship that were both false and demeaning. Remember all those gods that we talked about with the plagues and, you know, the bugs that they worshipped, as well as the sun and these other forces of nature? Can you imagine as a human being bowing down to an image of a cockroach? I mean, that's basically what was going on as a part of their worship. That's what the context that they had come out of. I mean, later they themselves, like faithful Egyptians in heart, what are they going to do? They're going to make a golden calf, just what they had learned back there. And God says, look, I took you out of that. That's stupid. You're a human being made in the image of God. What are you doing bowing down to a cow? That's ridiculous. So don't make any images or think that this is how you worship me. Now, I just reminded you as well that through the Exodus, God was revealing the meaning of his name Yahweh and how precious that was to them over against all these false gods. So doesn't it just make sense that God would say, now, having given you my name, don't take it in vain. Don't misuse it. Don't try to use it in some kind of manipulative way for some purpose that's not appropriate. Think about the Sabbath as well. The Egyptian masters had total control over the work and over the time of Israel. And those masters used that authority to abuse these people. In the fourth commandment, God is reasserting his own authority over their work lives and over their week. And God, so different from these abusive, power-hungry masters, says, you know what, going forward, everybody, even the slaves, everybody gets a day off. That's an answer to some of the abuse that they had suffered back in Egypt. Think about the laws that have to do with the family, whether it is honor for parents or faithfulness in marriage, or whether it is your relationships with other people and your respect of their lives. Hadn't Pharaoh grossly violated family bond and the value of life by killing the babies of Israel in the waters of the Nile? And God says, look, I took you out of that terrible sewer of humanity, a fallen, depraved humanity. Now, respect life and be faithful to your families, whether it's your parents or your children, for that matter, or your spouse. It only makes sense. Think about this as well, that the Israelites, a lot of what drove the Egyptians to treat them that way was their greed, their hunger for power and wealth, and to be at the top of the pile of humanity. And in that process, the Egyptians had basically stolen the work and the products of the work of the people of Israel. All of that represented a gross miscarriage of justice. And in Commandments 8, 9, and 10, what was the Lord establishing there? He was teaching respect for private property. He was teaching the importance of justice, specifically in bearing true witness in a court of law. And he was addressing the heart of greed that so often is behind the unjust ways that we treat our fellow man. Folks, do you see the wisdom that is woven all through these commandments as the Lord is calling on these people to respond in obedience? On one level, it's like, of course we ought to obey Yahweh. He spared us from all the oppression. He delivered us from the harsh and cruel master that was Pharaoh. He brought us under his own loving rule. Willing and glad obedience to him is the only response that makes any sense. Now think about in the New Testament again, where the commandments are being discussed of various kinds, and John makes this statement almost in passing, and his commandments are not burdensome. Right? We tend to view our obligations to God as some of this kind of heavy thing that's just unreasonable and impossible. By his grace, when we have the right focus, part of which is this perspective that it's for our good and that it's all wise. It's like, hey, God help me. I know I'm weak. I need your grace to do this, but this makes perfect sense. It's not some unreasonable burden. And yet there's more to be said than that. These laws themselves were designed to keep the nation Israel from becoming like the garbage they had experienced in Egypt. He carefully crafted those Ten Commandments so that they would promote a wise and honest and just and loving society. Those laws were the solution to the problems that had long troubled Israel in Egypt. And they were designed not to demean or oppress the Israelites, but actually to enable them to flourish as the special people of God. And folks, I want to encourage us, whether we're looking at New Testament commands or the applications of the Old Testament commands to our lives, to have that thoroughly positive view of the will of God for our lives. It is the only thing that makes sense given the magnitude of the grace of God that we have received through Jesus. And it is also the only thing that makes sense given that God is all wise and he knows what is wrong and destructive in the world, and he also knows what is best for us. And I can think of no better way to make that point than to quote a famous and beloved gospel passage that is moving toward our sanctification. Paul says this in Romans chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, it's a response to his grace, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is what? Your reasonable service. This is not some crazy life that God is calling you. This is the thing that makes sense given who God is and given who we are. And here we are this morning thinking about the Lord's Supper specifically. And 1 Corinthians 11 is going to urge us to do what? To partake of the Lord's Supper in a worthy manner. Again, it makes sense. It's reasonable. It flows from who the Lord is in our relationship with Him. And as we sit before these emblems of the suffering and the cross of Christ, what is the only thing that makes sense as the response to that? Humility, confession of sin, reconciliation with our brothers and sisters, love for God, and adoration of Him. And I trust that the Lord would